meeting is now being recorded.
Hi, this is Greg Shatton, and welcome to jurisdiction subgroup meeting for the CCWG Accountability Workstream 2. This is meeting number 19, and in spite of what it says there, it's January 30th, 2017. Apologies for the typo. At least I know what day it is now, even if I didn't when I was typing the agenda. First, would like to see if there is anybody who is on audio only. Hearing none, I see we have one phone number in the participants list, but that's been identified as Barbara Warner, so we're good there. Any changes to SOI? Everyone's stable, who's on the call, at least in terms of their intro. So why don't we move into the first agenda item. We talked about the timing of the questionnaire on the last two calls and essentially kind of came to a somewhat different conclusion on the last call than the preliminary conclusion from the first call. And there were concerns raised by those who were not on the second call that perhaps their interests and views were not adequately taken into account, especially in terms of desire to get comments or rather input experiences from outside the usual ICANN circle. On the last call, the conclusion was that we would have the questionnaire released around February 8th or 9th, and then close that period on March 24th, which is about a week or so after the end of the ICANN 58. On the previous call, we were looking at dates somewhat later than that, but the March 24th date was chosen with the thought that we could extend it an additional 2 weeks if that appeared to be warranted. Concern that was expressed on the list was that there would be a desire that, particularly for members of the GAC, to discuss the questionnaire and then bring it back to their stakeholders afterwards. And the GAC tends to do more of its work at the ICANN meeting, and therefore a date that begins in February 9th doesn't necessarily achieve a goal of broad dissemination. If the cutoff date it comes soon after the ICANN meeting. So my tentative thinking is to basically tack the two-week potential extension on and make it an actual extension. So to take it from the 24th of March, 2 weeks out, which would make it the 7th of April. That way, and I think we would want to make the point that it's non-extendable at that point. It's well been open for a long time. And I think we would also want to make the point that regardless of the closing date, we would like people to respond as soon as possible, and we will consider inputs as they're received. We'll consider them all equally, but we can begin to consider them during the comment period. I am hopeful that might meet the concerns of everybody. I know that some of those who raised the issue on that call or after the last call are not on this call either, but nonetheless, I don't want to let that be a hindrance to having their viewpoints considered. So I will take a queue, and any thoughts on those dates? Any thoughts? Love them, hate them, don't care. I'm taking primarily don't care as the answer, and since some people do care, I'd like to take that into account. Sometimes I am tempted to run this by the Socratic method and just call on people, have them tell us what we're thinking about, but that would be, that's a different model for a different place and time. In any case, I see not don't care, but seems okay. So reasonably enough, okay. No reason to speak up, but no reason in any either direction. Bernie, your hand is up.
Since we don't have our friendly GAC representatives here, I feel that it's my duty that I'm certain Caboose would remind us that he has and been supported with some of his GAC colleagues for 30 days after ICANN 58. So I just wanted to make sure that, given he's not here, maybe for health reasons or whatever, that this got mentioned.
Thank you, Bernie, for reminding us of that. That is true. Now, a full 30 days afterwards would take us out all the way, essentially, to, let's see if my math is right here. Basically, April 17th, as opposed to April 7th. April 7th is still roughly 3 weeks after, 21 days after the end of the period. Some other GAC members were initially suggesting 2 weeks. So it seemed to me that 3 weeks is perhaps something that, while it's not exactly what anybody has asked for, it's it seems reasonable. On the other hand, if there's anybody who thinks we should go to the full, all the way to April 17th rather than April 7th, which would, you know, completely satisfy Bruce's request, it will leave this open, you know, quite a long time. Be interested to know. Let me ask this. Does anybody object to having it open all the way until April 17th, non-extendable, encouraging people to submit early in the proceeding, nonetheless? Aubrey.
I put my hand down when you changed the question. I was going to argue for the full April 17th. It's better to give the time than to argue about how much time we're going to give.
Thank you, Aubrey. I guess we were thinking along the same lines as I changed the question. So I think that in spite of everyone, you know, certain desires to keep things moving, I think we will have plenty of work without the outside inputs. And I'm hopeful that we will get outside inputs earlier in the period, and we need to write, and I'll circulate quickly around a, you know, quick 2 or 3 sentence kind of procedural introduction as opposed to the preamble that will just indicate this, and that will be translated along with everything else. So I wanted to get that hashed out. So I think, in the interest of giving full time on this and taking interest fully into account, I think we should extend this then to April 17th, non-extendable, and the encouragement to go earlier. I see a question in the chat. Where will the questionnaire be posted? The questionnaire will be posted, or rather the introduction to the questionnaire will be posted on the public comment page for ICANN, where, you know, all of the usual public comments show up. Then, you know, that would link to a page, you know, that while it would not look like the usual public comment page, it would still, you know, be accessible from the public comment overall listing. And then, you know, that further can be publicized, you know, any way that any particular organization wants to, and it would appear in various blasts that ICANN puts out, you know, the daily ICANN roundup and things like that. So that's that. Anything else on the questionnaire? A quick work plan note from Mathieu. Mid-April is 2 months away from Johannesburg. Might be difficult to be in a position to have a first reading by then. I think that what we need to do is to do our work around the outside inputs. We don't know how many we'll get, how useful they'll get, you know, continue to move forward. You know, doing those strictly as an additional input.
No, I haven't been.
Any other thoughts on that?
No. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Your microphone. I think that, yeah, we need to look at the effect on the timeline. I think, you know, I think we'll need to manage the rest of our work so that we are, you know, moving along even as other things go forward, because, you know, if we miss Johannesburg, we're kind of all the way to Abu Dhabi, and that is takes us way off of our hoped-for plan. That's, you know, obviously, as Matthew said, not a deadline, but we should keep ourselves moving. Any further comments on this point before we move to the hypothetical? Seeing none, can we put the hypothetical up on the screen? I think the PDF of the PowerPoint is probably the most effective version to post.
Greg, before we start the next point.
Yes, Bernie.
Just for clarity in the notes. So we're settled. It's closing on April 17th, and there will be no extensions, and there have been no objections to this. Is that where we're at?
That is correct.
Okay, it will be recorded as such. Thank you.
So this hypothetical is basically drawn from the first item in our influence of existing jurisdiction document in Section C, where we're supposed to be raising issues that or influences that come from ICANN's governing law, choice of law, venue, that I think is, in a sense, the heart of our work, but we have not spent as much time on it as I would have liked, or any of us would have liked. So if we could go to the second slide, please. Here we are. So I circulated this on Friday. I'd hoped some might comment on it in advance, but did not. But that's, of course, we had a weekend in between. So this is just, I'll just read the hypothetical out. It's not very long. A plaintiff initiates litigation challenging ICANN's actions or inaction involving actual operation of its policies, like delegation of a GTLD and or acceptance of certain terms of registry operation, on the basis that plaintiff or a class, including plaintiff, would be injured and that ICANN's actions or inactions are in violation of law. The court finds that ICANN's actions or inaction violates the law and issues an order requiring ICANN to change its act. So the question is, now, what are the influences of ICANN's existing jurisdiction for governing law and venue on the actual operation of ICANN's policies, on ICANN's accountability mechanisms, and on the resolution of disputes? If there are no influences, or the influences are not negative, then essentially we don't have a jurisdictional problem arising from this. There's no need for any to consider any changes or remedies of any sort. And if we do have issues or gaps or negative influences or however you want to look at it, then we may have to consider whether, in fact, there might need to be any ways to resolve those or remedy those issues. So in order to just get the conversation started, I prepared some straw man answers. These are not final answers. These are not even necessarily my answers. They should not limit discussion, but instead should start discussion. To a great extent, these are lifted from the influence of existing jurisdiction document. So if we could go to the next slide, hopefully you can keep this hypothetical in mind. And so here are some potential answers to the question of what is the influence of governing law and venue on the actual operation of ICANN's policy. I don't know if anybody thinks any of these are right, wrong, should be phrased differently, has any new ones other than these for this particular point, the operation of policies. I would love some feedback on these. We've had some time to consider them now. These are, as I say, from the document. Don't all start at once. David McCauley.
Greg, hi. David McCauley for the transcript. And I'm trying to come up with one. I guess one of the difficulties I'm encountering is that in the hypothetical, the plaintiff initiates litigation, et cetera, it's not specified what went wrong. You know, was it some esoteric action that only applies to this GTLD, or does it have to do with an expert panel decision that was arguably incorrectly decided? So I think that may be I've been thinking about this ever since I read it, and I just having a hard time coming up with an answer. I do think, that you're right to say in the straw man that it could be a positive influence, I think that it might be nice to indicate that there could be appeals and what that might do to the process. But I guess I'm struggling because there are so many potential details to litigation, and a lot of which will make it very, very esoteric and unique, in fact, to the parties at issue, that there may not be a message back to ICANN except that, you know, it blew this one particular fact situation. I don't know if that helps, but that's part of the struggle I'm having. Thank you.
Thanks, David. I think that's a helpful comment, that essentially the hypothetical is too vague or lacks sufficient facts to go in too many different directions. We might need to try to pin it down or come up with, you know, one specific fact hypothetical as opposed to just the idea that somebody sued ICANN for some reason. That had to do with some exercise of some policy or exercise of its an action that was dictated by policy or perhaps was not properly dictated by policy. That's a very broad generalization. And for there, I see that perhaps the discussion doesn't need a hypothetical. Maybe it's more general. But I think, and you'll see that we do have some bullet points here, that it is possible from something as generic as this to talk generically about what the influences might be. In some cases, the influences might be positive or negative, depending upon the actual fact. Both what the complaint was, and whether it's something, you know, esoteric or something, you know, a clear violation of law, and also on what the court did. If the court ruled in this hypothetical, we do have the court ruling against ICANN. Avery asked, does the nationality of the plaintiff feed in any complexity? I think it may, in terms of when we get to to C, which is the kind of the resolution of disputes. Other than that, I'm not sure that the nationality of the plaintiff makes a difference in this scenario, but obviously willing to, we should, you know, have other viewpoints on that. Now, David says, I would think the plaintiff's nationality is not that important, rather the court is. Aubrey says it was a genuine question, not leading or Socratic. Definitely, I take it as such. I think, you know, one might say that if the plaintiff is a national of another country, it's conceivable they might have difficulty commencing litigation, or they might feel like they shouldn't need to do it in a court where ICANN can be sued. But that's, of course, just, you know, the way things generally run. And, of course, ICANN potentially can be litigated against in courts other than those of California, given its presence in a number of places around the world. So I think that's – it's not so much an issue of the nationality so much as it is an issue of kind of generally whether one wants to be found in a court other than one's home court, so to speak. But typically the defendant has to be found in the court that you have available to it. Plaintiffs, of course, can be very creative in trying to hail a defendant into the court of the plaintiff's choice. But that's kind of getting into subtleties at kind of the next level. This is the plaintiff, this at least assumes a U.S. court and a plaintiff of unknown origin suing ICANN in a U.S. court. Well, why don't we take a stroll through these suggested influences that came out of the influences document, some of which were contributed by me, but hopefully not all, and would like to add to the list if we can. Well, first, the influence of this, in this hypothetical, would be a positive influence, as ICANN will be aware that any actions that violate such policies can be challenged. Any comments on that point? Valid, invalid, misses the point. It's good. I think it's good. That's just one voice and a neutral voice. Okay. Secondly, moving on then, if the court finds for ICANN, it's a positive influence, as this will increase confidence that ICANN is properly carrying out its policies and that its policies do not violate the law. So that, in essence, is that is accountability of a sort. I mean, any, to my mind, any litigation is in essence an exercising accountability. In this case, ICANN has been held accountable and they've been found to be acting appropriately under the law. Any thoughts on that? I'm assuming these are all in the general neighborhood of good thoughts. Otherwise, people would be saying something. If that's an unfair assumption, please say something. Third, if the court finds for the plaintiff, this could also have a positive influence. Certainly, if the policies or actions of ICANN violated the law, this shows that ICANN can be found held accountable in a court, that it is a appropriate forum for accountability, and that if anybody's concerned, ICANN might get hometown treatment in a U.S. court, in a California court, that a finding for the plaintiffs would potentially dispel that. So that's also a positive influence. On the other hand, if the court's fine for plaintiff, it could also have a negative influence. If ICANN's policies or actions were within ICANN's mission and in the public interest and were nonetheless ruled in violation of law. So here we have, in essence, a feeling by the, at least ICANN, or even ICANN in the community, that the actions were kosher, so to speak, and yet the courts ruled against them. Aubrey.
Yeah, on your third bullet, I see the point you're making, but I think the thing to say there is that this becomes a test for ICANN. I mean, at that point, in terms of how it deals with that, you know, does it just find some quick remedy or does it fix policy? So, in other words, I think you want to indicate on that third one, and perhaps that is contained in the meaning of could. But that basically that this does create a test for ICANN in terms of its reactions, something like that. Thanks.
I think that's a good point. Definitely, I mean the court's decision is not, you know, generally speaking, self-executing. ICANN would need to follow it, appeal it, disregard it. How it decided to follow it. All of those are potentially kind of a test for how ICANN deals with, you know, being held to account in a court of law. Thanks. Continuing into the back to the fourth bullet, where we have something that seems to be, or we think is within ICANN's mission in the public interest, but has been found to be a violation of law. So I've got two sub-bullets here. If the case was correctly decided, in other words, this in fact violated U.S. law or the governing law that was applied, which might not be the U.S. law. So in fact, ICANN is violating the law in spite of its doing something within its mission and the public interest, and that's entirely possible. This could also have a positive effect because ICANN would need to improve its policies so that it did not violate the law while still meeting its goals. So that is a positive accountability effect and a positive effect on ICANN's policies. Of course, if the case was wrongly decided, and that's a judgment, obviously, this could have a negative effect in that it would undermine credibility in the law or in the venue, and would also conceivably force ICANN to change policies that were in fact legal. And Matthew asks, who is judging on correctly or wrongly decided? That's highly subjective. Clearly the court thinks they got it right. And if ICANN thinks they didn't, they would have the ability to appeal in almost all cases. And appeals are not at all uncommon or disfavored, at least in the U.S. court system. So I think it may be that the case, you know, would need to be appealed. And so I guess there's, you know, the question, just something that looks terribly wrong to everybody in the community, and somehow it just seems like something went awry in the court. Hopefully that would be appealed, if that's the case. And that basically, in a long-winded way, restates what Phil Corwin said just after the 1434 mark. I think we should, I think Aubrey makes a good point. When you mark all the points in the hypothetical where there should be some action by the board or ICANN or the empowered community, that, in a sense, you know, is a question. It's not just, you know, what the court does. That's the question. So any other comments on the effect in this hypothetical of governing law and venue on the actual operations of ICANN's policy? I'll take it that, you know, so I've got a couple of good comments here from folks, and let's move to the next slide. As we're moving to the next slide, let's see, Phil Corwin writes, in my humble opinion, the key consideration is that ICANN is headquartered in a jurisdiction with a clear commitment to the rule of law, and that any party with standing can initiate litigation regardless of their home jurisdiction. Aubrey replies, well, it's sometimes easier said than done. My screen, at least, is not moving to the next slide. Could we move to the slide that has B on it? There we are. Other than kind of what was noted in the previous slide that also kind of goes to accountability, this was the only thing that was said on in the document as to accountability effect. That would have a positive influence on ICANN's accountability, as it's shown that the plaintiff was able to challenge ICANN's actions and seek to hold it accountable. Now, you know, it should be noted that the enforceability, which we spoke a lot about in the WorkStream 1, in essence dovetails with this hypothetical. We don't know who the plaintiff is. The plaintiff could be the empowered community in this particular hypothetical. It doesn't have to be. But generally speaking, the fact that by any other legal entity is a positive influence on ICANN's accountability. And the ability of ICANN to sue and be sued in court is noted as one of the existing accountability measures at the very beginning of Workstream 1 when they were cataloged. One of them, among the, those that are noted, is the headquarters location in California and the ability to have to find ICANN and litigate it. So let's, any further thoughts on accountability mechanisms? Hearing none, we can move to the next slide, which gets a little more complicated. In this case, we're really talking, I felt it was important to split between governing law, in other words, what law, what substantive law has been chosen for the case to be litigated under. You know, it could be U.S. law. That's the, you know, true of the vast majority of cases in U.S. courts, but there are times when the laws of other jurisdictions are chosen, either in a contract where there's a choice of law provision or through choice of law rules, or sometimes called conflicts of law rules, that exist in a jurisdiction. And in the influences of jurisdiction document, there's a fairly lengthy appendix that shows how conflicts of laws are typically resolved when there's an issue about which law would be applied. So that's the governing law side of things. So the governing law, in my mind, you know, clearly influences the case. It's the prism with through which every, you know, the view of whether it's legal or illegal or violates the law or not is viewed. So a difference, as between any two jurisdictions, decisions could be different, although, you know, the laws of, you know, various countries, various places are, tend to be more similar than not, but that, of course, has 1,000 footnotes or 1,000 exceptions to it. So under a different law, ICANN's policies or actions could be viewed differently. There could conceivably be different burdens of proof. For instance, you know, typical civil court action has a preponderance of the evidence burden. But there are higher burdens in you know, very certain kinds of cases, and in criminal cases, it's a beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the highest and most difficult burden to meet. There could be different standards of review of ICANN's actions, whether it's a clear error or de novo review, what deference they would give to ICANN's judgment. It also, of course, depends on what kind of case it was. There'd be different remedies, different causes of action, might be available or unavailable in different jurisdictions, and even different rules on who pays. U.S. is typically everyone pays their own expenses, whereas there are many jurisdictions that are loser pays jurisdictions. Well, that's not necessarily the question of governing law as much as it might be one of venue. Matthew.
Thanks, Craig. Matthew May speaking. I'm reading this part as sort of pleading for consistency and predictability, and certainly that's one of the aspects we need to look at. However, I'm a bit uncomfortable with the sort of the underlying impression, which is that if there were other jurisdictions with different standards of review, different remedies, they would not be as good as the U.S. one. And I think we should correct this because I see the fact that potentially disputes can be settled in different governing laws, in different jurisdictions, as actually bringing ICANN closer to be accountable to the global type of rules. And I'm not in a position, or I don't think we are, to say that the way it's dealt with in the U.S. Governing law and in the U.S. jurisdiction is any better or any worse than anywhere else. So if ICANN can be challenged in another jurisdiction, maybe it's for the better, for the best in terms of accountability as well. So I don't know exactly yet how to maybe adjust this, but I think we should be careful not to put predictability above everything else, because in terms of accountability, it's not necessarily the case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mathieu. I think you're probably looking at the third bullet on the page, the first sentence, because I think everything else is fairly neutral. But I think that's the one statement where I think you're seizing on it, and I think rightly so. It says, assuming U.S. jurisdiction, to the extent ICANN's policies and actions are generally consistent with U.S. law, this would tend to make the outcome more predictable. The thinking is if ICANN is seeking to adhere to U.S. law, and it's the governing law is U.S. law, then ICANN is more likely to be found to be not in violation of it than if the same actions are viewed through a law that has different standards. Now, it's entirely possible, given conflicts of law, that if ICANN were sued in a French court, that conflict of laws rules in French jurisprudence would also dictate the application of U.S. law. If ICANN is, you know, taking the actions in U.S. jurisdiction, so it's kind of it's not necessarily about the venue, but about the governing law, which is why this is split in two. You know, so I think the question of how many governing laws ICANN is actually accountable under or to kind of gets back to that question of applicable law. What laws are applicable to ICANN's actions and where can it be found accountable? And, you know, I'm not sure that that's exactly how we fit that into our work. I think ICANN is, to an extent, potentially subject to a number of jurisdictions' substantive laws, but that's an analysis that's way beyond the off-the-cuff analysis. And, of course, there are laws that are in conflict with each other in some cases that you might or might not want ICANN to have to abide by the law of country X if it's vastly different than, say, U.S. and European law harmonized together, that it's an outlier to that kind of general legal system that you might find perhaps in many countries that are harmonized together under common rules, as outliers to everything, perhaps. I think we need to consider that, but that's, I think, kind of a next-level issue is. And maybe this gets back to something that Jean-Jacques Supernat was discussing earlier in our arc of meetings, which is what he called additional jurisdiction. And maybe we may need to get back to that. Of course, you know, we can't change the laws of the world or how they view the applicability of governing law other than the extent that those can be consented to. So to some extent, we have to take the law or the laws of the world as we find them. So on this page, I think we've actually covered the points here. And I agree, you know, we need to make no assumptions that U.S. law or U.S. governing law applied wherever it is applied is a somehow the highest possible standard. Why don't we go to the next page? Now we're over to venue. In other words, what court are you in, which could be a state court, a federal court in the United States, California, not California, court of a different country, and potentially different levels of courts in those countries as well. So a different venue could choose to apply a different governing law based on what its conflicts of laws rules are. It could cost less or more than the U.S. jurisdiction that is in the hypothetical, different burdens of proof, different remedies, different rules on who pays, different approaches to transparency in terms of whether the courtroom is open, whether opinions are published, how quickly, et cetera, different approaches to appeals, different evidentiary standards, predictability could be higher, more or less than U.S. predictability, could be quicker or slower than U.S. courts, and also could take place in a different language other than that used in U.S. courts, which is English. These are influences. They're not meant to be positive or negative. I think I've avoided that on this page in terms of a presumption that Matthew called out. These could influence the outcome of the case, the type of redress remedies, that is, and the financial burden. So my nutshell view of what happens in the U.S. court here, and again, this is only the beginning of a discussion. Don't take it as gospel. Assuming a U.S. court, U.S. conflict of laws rules would apply. The proceedings would be relatively costly. That's my view of our litigation system versus many other countries, but that's not absolute. Damages and equitable relief, causing actions to be changed, would both be available. Each party would bear their own costs, except under exceptional circumstances. The hearings and pleadings would be public. The case would be appealable. Preponderance of evidence would apply if it's a typical civil case. The outcome would be relatively predictable, some might argue. There, I was once told as a junior litigator before I stopped doing such things so much that there's always a 10% chance the judge is crazy. So you can't ever say that there's a 100% chance of the case being decided the right way. Case would move relatively slowly, although there are rocket dockets and other ways of moving things forward more quickly. And the case would take place in English. Translations may be available in some ways. Some might say the case is more likely to settle, since the vast majority of cases in U.S. courts actually tend to settle rather than getting heard all the way through to an opinion, but I'm not sure if that's more or less likely than other jurisdictions. But any other thoughts on the effect of venue in this generic hypothetical? I can't get sued. I can't lose it. Let's switch to the next and last piece of this. Just one other factor. In a common law jurisdiction, such as the U.S., U.K., most of the Commonwealth, former Commonwealth countries, the outcome of the case would serve as precedent in future cases. It would essentially be added to the law, if you will, assuming court that the case in the U.S. took place in court and not in arbitration, which has no precedential value. And this would also involve not just cases involving ICANN, but cases involving entirely different parties. So that's the end of kind of the thinking here. That's how the thinking of how it would influence the resolution of disputes. Of course, everything that came before could also be seen in some way as a discussion of how the resolution of disputes will be influenced by the governing law on the venue. Quickly take a look at the next slide. The left hand, this kind of goes to what David said. This is a very generic hypothetical. At least one phrase used in it, acceptance of certain terms of registry operation, is vague in and of itself. We don't know who the plaintiff is. We don't know exactly what law, what harm, what governing law is actually being applied, et cetera. So the answers to these questions could influence the specific outcome of the case, but whether it's we come to different conclusions about what the influences of jurisdiction or, you know, governing law and venue are, maybe the answer to that is no. We wouldn't come to different conclusions. David.
Great, thanks. David McCauley for the transcript. On this list, I think it might help us going forward if we added some discrimination here. And what I would suggest, maybe this would help us a little bit, is that we segment questions in two ways. One is issues that relate to corporate governance, such as a violation of the bylaws, you know, where the board approved something by a 51% vote, but if you went and read the bylaws, you would see that they had to have had a 66% vote. Those kinds of questions, corporate governance questions. And then the other category would be everything else. I recognize that people can argue that if ICANN breaches a contract, it's thereby violating its bylaws. I think that's sort of an ancillary and immaterial argument in that case. It would really be a breach of contract claim. And so maybe that would help us where we sort of understand that U.S. law, California law specifically, would have a greater impact on corporate governance questions because that's where ICANN is incorporated. And whereas for other questions on operations and things like that, it could be the U.S., it could be where there's an engagement office, a hub office, and arguably elsewhere. Maybe that would help. Thank you.
Greg, if you're speaking, we're not hearing you.
Thanks, Bernie. Forgot about the mute. Thank you, David. That's very helpful. I think we should, you know, that's a good question to ask. You know, what, you know, that there are certainly, I think, different types of causes of actions or actions by ICANN that would be viewed, you know, significantly differently. I think we can add that to the list here. So I think, to some extent, this is a template for how we can look at other hypotheticals, and would like to find some other hypotheticals. The other hypotheticals in C, to my mind at least, that is the Section C of Influences of Jurisdiction, actually don't go to the issue of the influence of governing law and venue in the settlement of disputes. They don't actually relate to settlements of disputes. That doesn't mean they're irrelevant to our work at all, but it does mean they're not relevant to that document and to that exploration, which is our actual focus. Yes. I use the term alternative facts with a little bit of knowledge of current events, so to speak. But in this case, these are, since it's a hypothetical, all the facts are alternative facts, as opposed to in reality where only one set of facts are facts. So let's put this aside and just briefly go back to the agenda with the 4 minutes we have left. Just to touch briefly on the fact that we do now have a fairly decent-sized small group looking at the ICANN's actual litigation, present and past litigation, and trying to summarize them, and showing exceptional leadership. Mathieu Valle was the first in the small group to submit his summaries, also helps us as the kind of guinea pig to try to improve the summary sheets, which I will do. You know, consistent with the discussion that's been being had among the small group about how to improve some of the answers and to make the questions more clear as to what the answers are. So if anybody wants to be part of the small group and isn't yet, there's still time. Mathieu, is that a new hand?
Yes, that's a new hand, Greg. Just asking, we'll wait for your direction in terms of any update to the standard form following the discussion, the very useful discussion with Paul and Milton. And it would be easy to adjust once you update this, if that's agreed. Thanks.
Actually, yes. Yesterday I was out protesting and marching in a Battery Park in Lower Manhattan, so I was not I was not in front of my computer. And I was too tired from protesting and marching. So I will do that today. In terms of what else is on the list of our agenda here, of course, the influence of ICANN's existing jurisdiction document is one people should be looking at, but I think that we need to look at existing, at other hypotheticals that go to this question of ICANN's existing jurisdiction for disputes, the governing law and choice of law and venue, and how those are influenced. So I'll put another call out. Caboose in December collected a series of questions that have been posted to the list. I will look back at Caboose's list and see if any of those can be turned into hypotheticals that are germane to this category of issue. So we'll do that, but obviously, you know, the more hypos we have, the better, especially until we get actual experiences rolling in from our questioning. Under AOB, I'll just note that David McCauley did draft an initial request to ICANN Legal, which needs review, not only because it's out for review. I'm not saying it needs review, but it's out for review. I'll need to take a closer look at that and make sure everybody else does, and we'll do that. And any other thoughts about what information we might need from ICANN Legal would be helpful. So, the deadline for public comments is the 17th of April, non-extendable. Answer early. Don't wait for the deadline. Kind of like filing your taxes. I think it's actually the same day as the taxes, perhaps even. Maybe it's the 18th to the 17th or some holiday in D.C. only. But that doesn't matter. Anyway, so we will get the questionnaire translated now that we know how the introductory paragraph should or what it should take into account. We'll get the questionnaire started and out there. We do not yet have a schedule for our next meeting in February, but we'll go over the February calendar and schedule something, trying to stick to our rotation as much as possible. But we did have two 1300s in a row, so at some point we may end up with two 1900s in a row, or we may not count things as necessarily being in a row if they're interrupted by ICANN meetings or whatever. I will be at the Non-Contracted Parties House Intercessional the week of the 13th, so I'll have to think about how to handle that. So I'll be in Reykjavik. Aubrey will be there too, maybe a couple others who are at least in this group, if not on this call. So with that, I thank you all. Ask you to think about this hypothetical. Ask you to think about other hypotheticals, maybe ways that if you made some changes to this hypothetical, you might have some different ideas about influences of jurisdiction. This is what we're trying to figure out, whether, in fact, there are influences and what they are and what we need to do about it. And so I will draft that cover note for Bernie, as he knows. I thank you all, and look forward to our meeting next week. And this meeting is now adjourned. Bye, all.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks, Greg. Fabulous.
Thank you all.